The financial markets that are confounding the experts in a good way.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM in New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update. Welcome to the second half of 2014. That's where we are this morning with that key index of stock prices, the S&P 500, trading again in record territory, at least in early trading. After the stock market rocketed forth last year, one might have expected things to revert back to the mean, as the math people say. Beyond that, there's that market adage, sell in May and go away. Yet June was a pretty decent month for stocks, capping off a quarter in which the S&P 500 went up more than 4%. On Tuesdays, we check in with Julie Neiman, the analyst at Smith Moore & Company in St. Louis. Morning, Ms. Neiman.
Morning, David.
You know, a lot of folks thought that things would kind of fizzle out once May came to an end.
Well, there is an old adage, sell in May and go away, and it usually works, but not this time. We've got the longest streak since 2000 going on here for one major reason: don't fight the Fed. It's not tightening at all. They're just metering the money flood a little bit, and that free money from the Fed and real economic growth, not robust, but real economic growth, and we're talking globally. China and Japan are finally coming out, Spain, UK. Everybody is finally edging their way out of recession. So combine those two things, and we still have a very decent stock market. And your alternative is the bond market with 0% interest rates. It's hard to make a case for even being there.
And you, credit where credit's due, Julie. You said this notion of sell in May and go away wasn't your recommendation this time around, and it would have been not a great recommendation.
Well, and I thank you. We stay invested in the market because that's basically where the action is going to be for the foreseeable future. We'll get some internal corrections, no doubt about that. But it's going to be within industries that have gotten ahead of themselves. So you get a few swoons, but it's not going to be a significant rock bottom correction going on right now.
All right, Julie Neiman, Smith Moore & Company, thank you.
You bet.
More people have jobs than before the Great Recession started, but office workers are cramped into less space than before. A report today from the real estate information company Reis shows that only about half of the space lost during the recession has filled back up. Marketplace's Dan Weissman reports.
It's normal for office space to come back more slowly than employment. Ryan Severino is an economist with Reis.
As you go into a recession and companies lay off employees, oftentimes the size of their physical footprint can't shrink in accordance with that. So there tends to be a little bit of a mismatch.
In other words, when companies bring back workers, a lot of those companies already have a bunch of extra space to put those people in. Even when companies don't have extra space, say they're new or they were able to get out of their old lease and take a smaller space, increasing the footprint comes after hiring the people. First, the old space gets tight. Susan Wachter is a professor at the Wharton School of Business.
When you start doubling up that office space and you start hearing complaints, you're gonna start planning, but you need to know that people are on board and that you're going to need that space. And then that, too, takes time.
She says this recovery, we're seeing less pickup of office space than normal. Open layouts, which require less space per employee, have become more popular. And finally, budgeting for a move, that doesn't happen overnight. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
We are taught as children that sharing is good, so the sharing economy, as it's called, must be fabulous. The sharing economy is defined every which way, but some companies with a lot of cash flow these days, from internet car services like Lyft and Uber to room rental places like Airbnb, see themselves as part of all this sharing. Oakland, California-based reporter Susie Cagle went to a conference on the sharing economy and was left thinking that the word sharing is getting stretched completely out of shape. Ms. Cagle, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So your beef isn't with sharing per se. Sharing is good. Why should both neighbors own a separate lawnmower they could share? Your beef is what's being done in the name of quote-unquote sharing?
I think that there's a great misunderstanding going on with this new branding of the sharing economy. And there's a real dangerous casualization of work. You know, drive a car, make some money, hang out with your friends. It's not really a job. And that's a scary slippery slope.
And one of your sources raises a very interesting question in your piece. Who can share? Who can participate? It's not everyone. I mean, just for starters, you need to be in a socioeconomic class where you have a credit card often.
And then there are issues of really pretty blatant discrimination. The fact that it's been documented that on Airbnb, the best performers are white women. And the people who have the least luck on Airbnb are black men. There's a lot of talk about how the peer-to-peer economy is going to build trust and it's going to build new connections. That in a lot of ways, it looks like it's just trading on the same old connections, the same old discrimination, the same old access.
But here's the thing, Susie. I mean, you can pick on Airbnb, but would you rather someone give their money to intergalactically large Hyatt hotels or, you know, your neighbor?
I think that that's really kind of a false dichotomy. There are, again, a lot of great opportunities within this new kind of people-to-people economy. The issue is these companies shouldn't get a pass and they shouldn't be seen as a kind of a higher form of business. They're still a business.
Susie Cagle's piece, The Case Against the Sharing Economy, appears in The Nib, part of the online publishing platform Medium. Susie, thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Forbes has a gauge of economic clout of famous people that it calls the Celebrity 100. One thinks of Oprah forever at the top, which she was last year. But this year, Oprah fell to number 4 on this list. At the top now, Beyonce, whose concert tour reportedly made nearly $2.5 million per venue. Then there are the endorsements she gets, Pepsi, H&M. Basketball's LeBron James was the number 2 celebrity, with producer Dr. Dre at 3, driven by Apple's acquisition of his Beats headphones and music servers. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.